Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing,
this is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. All animals make noise, but only a literal handful of animals sing. Birds, of course, whales, and now to that exclusive list, you can add mice. That's right, mice sing. So if our furry friends do it, and our feathered friends do it, we might as well take a step back and look at what it is. In a moment, we'll be speaking with John Potter, singer and editor of the Cambridge Companion to Singing, to get some perspective on the whole idea of what constitutes singing in the first place. But to begin today, we welcome Dr. Timothy Holy. He is assistant professor of neurobiology at Washington University's School of Medicine and was part of the team that conducted the study that discovered that mice do, in fact, sing. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we get into the details, let's first play the sound of the mice singing.
Okay.
Now, you're saying that this is a song that we're hearing. This is singing.
It's a singing in the same sense that a bird song is considered song as well. It may not be exactly the same thing that a human would call a song in the way that my 4-year-old likes to sing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, etc.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it? I mean, at what point do you cross the threshold from, you know, a cat making a very specific kind of noise when it wants to be fed and another kind of noise when it wants to go out to song?
So that's a great question, and I think in some senses it really gets down to what is the definition of song, I think, as you're exploring in this program. So one of the things I think that's important to say is that even in the scientific community, I don't think there actually is a single definition of song that everyone agrees with. And in fact, when we were looking into it, the work that we looked at most carefully was actually someone who sort of explicitly recognized a hierarchy of meanings that song has had. And so for us, I think the features that together seemed kind of necessary for us to call it song were several. Well, one is that the sounds go on for a long time. When the mice actually start singing, they'll sometimes sing for 10 minutes at a time. Another is that there's a variety of syllable types in their vocalization. So it's not the same sound repeated over and over again, or let's say just a random collection of noises, but there's some systematic structure to the individual sounds.
Okay, so there's a variety and a period of time.
That's right. So a long period of time, a variety, but and not just variety, but in the sense of it's a variety of actual types, so that you can actually classify individual sounds into categories and discover that there are several categories. And then the final thing is that these different types, it also turns out, are structured in time. So there's one syllable type, for instance, which tends to be used sort of as what's been called an introductory note in birdsong at the beginning of a phrase. They have a tendency to repeat themselves before switching over to another syllable type. And sometimes you even see a very sort of repeated sequence of syllables several times in a row within the song. And it's a little bit reminiscent of human music in that we often will have, let's say, a chorus or something like that to a song.
Right. Now, Did you go about this research looking for singing mice, or was this just a kind of an accidental byproduct?
Purely an accidental byproduct. In fact, the main thing that we study in the lab is actually the sense of smell, and we're interested in trying to know, use the mouse sense of smell as a general tool for trying to understand how the brain does some of the interesting things that brains do. And so we sort of stumbled across this because we were just looking for a behavior that we could use to for instance get males to tell us whether they smell the presence of a female.
Mm-hmm.
And other researchers had found several decades ago that males will make these sounds up in the ultrasound when they smell female mouse pheromones,
mm-hmm.
The social signals. And so we thought, great, this is a behavior that we've been looking for. And so we started recording the sounds. And we recorded using a microphone instead of some of the, let's say, simpler detectors that had been used before. And that gave us enough of a view of what the sounds were that it became relatively quickly apparent that there might be something interesting there. Though it took us a while to convince ourselves that was true.
Yeah. Now, when you recorded the songs, you say they were ultrasonic. So what we just heard, that must have been lowered a couple of octaves.
Correct. Exactly. And there are at least two ways you can do that, and we've done both of them. One is to just play them slowly. And when you do that, they actually sound something like the humpback whale songs that many of the listeners have perhaps heard.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing about that, we sort of joked that they sound a lot like that. But the when they're played slowly like that, it's hard for me at least, and I think for others, to get some sense for sort of the structure over time. And so the other way that we altered them is to basically transpose the songs down four octaves in this case. And into our hearing range, and when we did that, it's actually a little harder to hear the differences between the syllables, but you gain the appreciation of the sort of meter, if you will, and
the overall shape of the line.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly it. Yep, that's right.
All right, so why would mice sing?
Well, we don't know the answer for that for certain. My speculation, at least, would be that it's for the purposes of courtship, and that's based mainly on the when they do it, which is when they're near a female or when they smell a female. It's been called to my attention more recently. There's been at least one study that seems to show that the females at least like to stay near a male that's singing. Whether that translates into a greater reproductive success for the male is something that, to my knowledge, has not been tested yet.
Uh-huh. So they're love songs.
That would be, I think, my best guess for what they are. But
okay.
But there could be, of course, there could be more to it than that, in the sense that it may play a role in territories or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's really speculation at the moment.
We're speaking to Dr. Timothy Holy, assistant professor of neurobiology at Washington University, and part of the team that found that mice have joined what is, Tim, a very exclusive list of animals that sing. And you said before there's no set definition, and I understand that with bats, for example, there are some scientists who claim that bats sing and others who claim that they don't, and I guess it depends on where you draw the line between
right.
noise and song. You mentioned that the study was originally involving the sense of smell and to figure out how the brain does what it does.
Mm-hmm.
Can this accidental result of your study offer us any insight into why we sing?
I think that's a good question. So yes, while my lab, I think, has focused on what the sense of smell can teach us about the brain, there are certainly many other labs that are devoted to using the sound and communication to learn more about the brain. So I think, in general, that's a very plausible phenomenon. I guess in terms of the specific role to human singing is one of the, I think, things that's a little bit complicated is it's unclear to me, at least, whether the best analogy with animal song is really human song or human speech. I think both are potential candidates for that, and there certainly have been very good arguments made on both sides of that. And so perhaps, in fact, the right answer is that there's something to be learned about either one of them. But some of the aspects that are even perhaps transcend the the specific question of whether it's speech or song, at least in birds, we don't know about it, whether this is true in mice. Birds clearly learn their songs from tutors. And mm-hmm. so, for instance, one way in which bird song is being studied very successfully is to learn more a little bit about how we actually learn new experiences or memorize something.
Well, Tim, it sounds like, as with any good piece of science, that you've succeeded in raising more questions than you've answered.
I do think that's the main sort of interest here, is that it basically just shows us that there may be opportunities to study things that I certainly wouldn't have guessed were even approachable in the past.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit more from your mice, your singing mice. We've been speaking with Dr. Timothy Holley, assistant professor of neurobiology at Washington University. And Tim, the whole question you raise of speech and song among humans, we're going to pursue that in a moment with John Potter. But let me thank you for joining us this afternoon on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
All right, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And now joining us by phone from the UK is John Potter, who is a former member of the world-renowned Hilliard Ensemble of London. He's currently in the music department at the University of York. He is also the editor of the Cambridge Companion to Singing. John, you've been listening in. These mice, does this sound like song to you?
It doesn't really sound like song, although down the line, the first extract you played sounded to me remarkably like the overture to Rossini's William Tell, only without the notes. but I guess the mice don't listen to Rossini much.
I guess not. Now, you teach a class called Sources for Singers.
Yeah.
How do you go about defining your terms? How do you define singing?
Well, that's a very hard one, and we did actually start the year by trying to do that very thing, and we couldn't come to any agreement, and I mean, there are lots of things one associates with singing, but one student even pointed out that that the larynx, which is the bit of the voice box that we normally use to sing with, was not designed originally to produce sounds, but its basic function is a valve to protect the lungs from ingesting stuff.
Hmm. So once again, singing being sort of an accidental byproduct, it sounds.
Indeed,
like.
Yeah.
Now, Tim was Dr. Holley was saying that, you know, as far as they were concerned in their research, the three elements that made it singing were that it had a certain length to it; it went on for a while, had a variety of syllable types, and that it was structured in time. There was some sense of rhythm or repetition. Does that sound about right in terms of human song?
The structuring in time, yes, definitely. I'm not so sure about the other two. That would depend on what sort of singing you're talking about, really. Hmm. I mean, there's a huge, I don't know how one would, there's a lot of variety in mice singing. I believe ants do it too, incidentally. But in human singing, there's a whole spectrum of things from that can encompass Puccini to singing in the bath or Tuvan throat singing. In any kind of vocal utterance that you could define as singing.
Could we say that perhaps humans as a species sang before they spoke?
That's also possible. I think the jury is out, and we'll probably never know, but there's no particular reason why, because we don't know what the original function of singing was, why speech should have come first. And you could have had the first utterance might have been for reasons like birdsong, which, as well as the mating aspect, is also to do with marking territory and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not inconceivable that the first human utterance was to do with that, in which case a singing could have easily come before speech.
Well, now, there are times in the history of human utterance where the line between speech and song has blurred. And I imagine Homer, you know, sitting around the campfire reciting the Iliad or the Odyssey was getting pretty close to song.
Well, if you read Quintilian or any of the ancient Roman and Greek authorities on rhetoric and oratory, you'll sometimes hear criticisms of people who say, if you're singing, then it sounds like speech, or if you're talking, it sounds like song. And Greek orators would need to be often given a note before they could deliver a speech.
Wow. Well, a modern equivalent to that, John, might be the Finnish choir known as Hutiat. You're familiar with this group.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us what's happening here. I mean, we can sort of hear for ourselves what's happening here, but how would you define this as singing?
Well, I would define it as singing if they do. The thing is that you can either define it as someone who does it, in which case it's whatever you decide it is, or it can be defined by someone who's listening to it. And I would also call that shouting as a listener.
Right.
But if I was doing it, I might call it singing.
Well, they refer to themselves as a Finnish shout choir,
yeah,
the group called Hutiat. So you're saying that in this kind of aesthetic judgment, the audience may have a different take on this from the people actually making the sounds.
Well, I think if you went to the Met and you heard your Puccini, you'd be quite happy with it as singing. If you went to the Met expecting Puccini and got the Finnish shout choir, you'd probably not think of it as singing.
Well, context is important in a lot of religious traditions as well. You know, when Muslims answer that call to prayer five times a day,
That
sounds like music to me, but is considered, absolutely just prayer.
Yeah, absolutely,
to the people who do it. We have a clip here of the monks of Tibet, the Gyuto monks of Tibet. Isn't this kind of the same thing, isn't it? In terms of being prayer for them, but kind of musical for us?
Yes, it is. And that Tibetan tradition of Overton singing, you also find in Tuva, for example, where similar techniques are used, but it's not religion. It actually is singing. And they just use a similar thing to sing songs about mostly horses rather than God.
Right. But in this case, with the Tibetan monks, they are simply very, very slowly chanting some sacred texts.
Yeah.
And yet, to us, it sounds like music.
Yes. And we would use those techniques, and techniques like that are used in extended vocal techniques as part of a kind of certain sort of singer's repertoire of sounds.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit from the Gyuto monks of Tibet. That's the sound of Tibetan chant has become familiar to world music fans, but again, it all depends on your context, and in the context of Tibetan Buddhism, that is not music at all, but rather a simple prayer. We're speaking with John Potter at the University of York. He is editor of the Cambridge Companion to Singing, about the larger issue raised by the study of the singing mice. What is singing? John, has the definition of singing changed over time, and does it vary with genre, say from classical to traditional to modern pop?
Well, there are certainly obvious differences between what we generally think of as pop music and classical music. Classical singing, particularly with men, you can identify particular historical points, even when you can't hear it, when it gets back beyond the gramophone, when singing changed, because people were impressed by the way things sounded, or particular singers sang, and things like press reports give you some idea of at least how different things were.
Mm-hmm. So we have some evidence that that the accepted standards of singing have changed over time.
Well, also the techniques. I mean, for example, there's a report in the Allgemeine Musikalische Zeitung in Germany in 1823 of a tenor called Domenico Donzelli, who was one of the first people to sing a top A in his chest voice. And it says he has a beautiful, mellifluous tenor voice with which he attacks the high A in full chest voice without once resorting to falsetto. And from that sort of report, we can tell that before that, it was customary to use falsetto in the top of the range.
Mm-hmm.
which is a way of singing that today's tenors like Domingo, Pavarotti certainly wouldn't consider in their normal way of singing.
Right. So today we expect our tenors to be able to hit those high notes
exactly,
without
yeah.
resorting to a kind of a Tiny Tim falsetto thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything out there? I mean, you seem to have a fairly generous range of what you would consider to be singing. Is there anything out there that tests your limits?
No, I think it's very much part of the ethos here in York that we would define singing in the very widest possible way, and whatever someone considers to be singing, we're happy with that. I haven't yet come across anything where I've had to say to the person, well, actually, this is gardening or something like that.
So the recording of the mice with their little mating song, if they say it's singing in whatever mouse language they have, you're willing to accept that?
I'd accept the mouse language, yeah.
All right. John Potter is a former member of the Hilliard Ensemble, currently singing with the group Redbird, and is the editor of the Cambridge Companion to Singing, also works in the music department at the University of York, has joined us on the phone from York. John, a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Here is a little bit of music from Joan LaBarbera, who does walk that line between sound and singing. Well, John Potter mentioned going to the Met and hearing your Puccini. In a moment, we will look at the story behind Giacomo Puccini, one of the world's most beloved but perhaps misunderstood composers. You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to an encore broadcast of Soundcheck that first aired in November of this year. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.